I appreciate everybody coming out tonight, and I would like to just mention a few things. I've known our guest over the phone for, I guess, a couple of years, and I bought some of the books that he has. Hans Anderson is the son of Verlin Anderson, who was 70 and wrote four excellent books. I've been privileged to obtain all four of them. Make sure I get this right. Moral Basis of a Free Society, The Book of Mormon and the Constitution, The Great and Abominable Church of the Devil, and Many Are Called But Few Are Chosen. Now that last book, Many Are Called, is available. Hans brought a case of them there tonight, and the ones that are $10 each. These are excellent books. I might also mention that Many Are Called But Few Are Chosen was recommended by President Benson in General Conference in the spring of 1972, and of course in the conference issue, The Ensign, in July of that year, so you can find that recommended. Incidentally, at the same time, he also recommended Prophets, Principles, and National Survival by Gerald Newquist, which I strongly recommend also, and The Elders of Israel and the Constitution by Jerome Horowitz, right? I think that's right. This was in the spring conference, April conference, 1972. That's a little bit about Hans's father, Verlin Anderson, was a... Well, I'm going to let him explain more of that. He'll do it a lot better, of course, than I ever would. But I've been privileged to visit with him on the phone, and we managed to get everything together so that he could come here tonight and talk to us, which I've been looking forward to for a long time. So I'm very pleased to introduce Hans Anderson to us this time.
Does this thing work? I better use it. I told Clark the only reason I'm here is because of who my father was. And that's okay. I thought he was a great man. He was one of Ezra Taft Benson's best friends. I didn't know how good friends they were until after he died. And I got to go through a pile of correspondence going back a lot of years. And I used to take it in and show it to my mother, and she'd say, "Oh, that makes me feel bad." And I'd say, "Why is that?" She'd say, "Well, I didn't know he was working on things like that." And it was really interesting to go through this stuff. He hadn't even told her, you know, a lot of the things that he was doing, that he was involved in. And that, as I went through his journals and this pile of correspondence and letters, references to things going back and forth, I just gained all the more love and respect for my father. One of the things that those men agreed on was the Book of Mormon and the Constitution. They agreed on a lot of other things. They, you know, sometimes I hear people getting in trouble with their bishop or with their, they write a letter to a general authority and they get called in, they get in trouble. And when I hear things like that, I think of this correspondence going back and forth between my dad and the prophet for 25 years. And I think, isn't that something, to see that kind of respect and love going between two good friends? And I thought, I wish everybody could have an experience like that with a general authority. That would be special. Well, go ahead, dear. Let's go up to the... I hope you can see these slides. This first one here is a letter that my father received from Ezra Taft Benson. And it deals with the subject we're going to be talking about here this evening. Now, I think most of you, we've probably got a lot of familiar spirits here, so most of you have probably heard something like this before. It's not unique. It's something that a lot of us have forgotten. What can I do to help? Is that possible? You silver-tongued fox, you talked me into it. Well, I believe this is a true statement, that we can learn more about what's going on in the world today by reading the Book of Mormon than all the books and periodicals, magazines. My father used to say this same thing. And you say that to people who don't think like you and I think, and maybe talk with friends who do think you like you and I think, and you say, well, what's going on? What is it that's going on that we ought to see? And that's the reason we're here tonight. Is to talk about some of these things that my father tried to identify that are parallels, things that we can look at. Let me have you refer to your handout. This has quotes from a talk J. Reuben Clark gave called America, a Chosen Land of the Lord. I think he gave this up at the University of Utah, and this is just a part of it. Maybe I could get you to read that for just a minute, where he talks about things he saw in the Book of Mormon that he thought applied to us today, things that he raised that most people would say, well, where did he ever get that idea from? You know, what does he know that we don't? Does he have the sealed portion? You know, where is he getting this from? But as we get on to look at a few more things, I think we'll see why he's not alone and why he came to the conclusion that he did. He talks about this fullness of iniquity when the government finally gets to supporting a vast body of idlers, and then how things fail, the economic system fails. Then he talks about the Nephites and about how they also had a fullness of iniquity. And he says it's the same thing. What's he talking about here? Now, welfare state, socialism. When you finally get to the end of your wickedness and you're worthy to be destroyed, wiped out, that's what he talks about here, the Jaredites and the Nephites. That's what they did. If you go to this next one, on the handout, again, this is David O. McKay. Back in 67, I don't know what goes on in this college, but we had a lot of socialists at BYU and a lot of students who believed in socialism. And Ernest Wilkinson went to President McKay. They were pretty good friends. And he said, I'd like to get something from you that I can give the students or give the faculty and the administration down here about what you think as the head of the Board of Trustees of this school. And it's a two-page letter. I just pulled a couple of pieces out of it. I know a little more of the history of it because my father was involved in it. He and Wilkinson were fairly good friends, too. But I want you to look at the third, fifth line down here. He says, history, of course, is replete with the downfall of nations who, instead of assuming their own responsibility for their religious and economic welfare, mistakenly attempted to shift their individual responsibility to government. And so, again, here's a prophet saying history is replete with the downfall of nations. And then he's the final piece I put in here. None of the doctrines of our church give any sanction to the concept of a socialistic state. That's back in 67. So we have David O. McKay, again, talking about the downfall of nations if they follow this trend. If you go to the... the next one, also on your handout, is one from the year before President McKay's letter to the faculty and the staff, the administration. Marion G. Romney came down. Maybe some of you recall that talk. This goes back a long ways. We're going back 40 years. But he gave a talk on socialism, the United Order compared. And his evaluation, again, if you go to the third line down there, talks about socialism as political. And it finally destroys all political governments which undertake to abridge man's agency. Then he goes on to talk about socialism. So it's not like we haven't heard these things. BYU needed this type of stuff, and so it was given to them. And here we've got the brethren attempting to help the students and the faculty give this to the students. Why do you think they were doing this? Any ideas? Why were they doing this? Yeah, we needed it. We needed to hear it. Got a lot of people upset, though. A lot of people didn't agree with it. My father taught at BYU for a lot of years, and I want to give you an illustration here of things he saw that make a little clear why these statements were needed. Here, will you go ahead and... my dad used to teach business law at BYU. He taught mainly upper division, junior and senior students that were majoring in accounting or business. He primarily taught returned missionaries. They're mainly men. And the first day of class, he used to give a questionnaire to his students. It had 25 or 30 questions on it, sometimes more, sometimes less. If you think where he's getting some of these questions from, raise your hand and tell the rest of us about it. But he wanted to try and get them to register what their political views were, what their political beliefs were before he started teaching the class. This was an ungraded test. They didn't even put their name on it. He just wanted to see what they believed. And this was one of the questions. Should government have the power to control natural resources? 78% said yes, 19% said no. Some didn't know. Let's go on to the next one. Do you feel you could draw a precise, line between those activities which should and should not be regulated? Yes, no. Okay, let's go to the next one. For providing for the less fortunate, the preface to all this is should government have the power to equalize all income? 2% said yes. 98% said no. And then the next question, the poor have some claim on the government. 55% said yes, 43% said no. Now, this is an average of several hundred students. I went through piles of these over several years to see, you know, how things were going, and things weren't getting a whole lot better. But anyway, go ahead and go to the next one. Do you favor graduated tax rates on income? 55 yes, 43 no. A return to the gold and silver standard, 39 to 60. A system of free public education, 72 to 23. Anybody have any idea where he's getting a lot of these questions from? Right out of the Constitution. Whose? You got a sense of humor. Yeah. Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx. I got that tongue-in-cheek humor they were referring to, yeah. Where they got it from. Yeah, these people had had a lot of problems. This is why they needed to hear these things from Jerwin Clark and Romney and McKay and others. You hope things have gotten a whole lot better, but I wouldn't bet lunch on it. Okay, here's one on licensing. License every economic activity. 18% yes, 80% no. Be completely without licensing power. 13% yes, 82% no. So again, we're evaluating their political views. And again, these are LDS returned missionaries who you'd think would know the gospel pretty well. And these are the kind of results we're getting out of this ungraded questionnaire. Go ahead and go to the next one. This is out of some of my father's writings. And as you pointed out, the Communist Manifesto was put together by Marx on how to destroy a capitalist society, which, as you saw earlier, quotes from Romney and McKay and Jerwin Clark, these are things that are going to destroy us, destroy our nation. And they destroyed other nations. That's what leads to it. And yet this is what we had at BYU going back 30, 40 years ago. These were their beliefs. This is just the Communist Manifesto. Where is he going? It's down in the last couple of sentences. Abolition of private property. He wrote those outlines up on how to destroy a capitalist society like America. And most of us in the LDS Church, out of the LDS Church, are communists. We already believe it. We've already been seduced to believe in this system. And yet, Dad pointed out when he talked about this is that most people had never read the Communist Manifesto. They had no idea what they believed. They didn't realize what they were a party to. He spent the next couple of weeks giving them statements from the brethren and the scriptures, the prophets, pointing out statements which have condemned these things from Joseph Smith all the way forward. Okay, now let's suppose that you're a prophet. And you understand these things. And let's suppose you think like David O. McKay or Jerwin Clark or Marion G. Romney, Ezra Taft Benson, and others that have tried to warn people about these things. And you warn them and you warn them and you warn them, but instead of believing you, they don't believe you. They don't accept what you have to say, that what they believe is taking them down the road to destruction. When do you cease to warn the people about this? Well, I think the obvious answer is the Lord decides that. He decides, when have I said enough? Back in 1970, when President McKay died, a few weeks after that, he died in January of 70, I asked my father one day, what's going to happen in the freedom battle now that President McKay is gone? because I knew that Ezra Taft Benson used to take those firebrand talks. You older ones remember him, but most younger people have no idea what he used to talk about in conference every 6 months without without a break. You always knew what was coming. It was going to be on socialism or communism or secret combinations or Gadant and robbers or welfare state or sex education. He carried the firebrand, and you heard it every 6 months. And President McKay used to hit it every year, every 18 months, something just as strong. He used to say stuff just as strong, too. But most people forget. President McKay had a way of delivering stuff that you knew that he loved you. President Benson, he didn't stay up nights trying to figure out how to make it sweet. I used to feel sorry for the liberals sitting there listening to him, because you knew about 5 seconds into his talk, the back of their hair was just going right up. I mean, it was war. And he let you know where you were wrong. And you didn't have to read between the lines. You could catch it in his phrases, the way he spoke, when he raised his voice. I mean, he dropped the hammer on you. And if you didn't agree with him, you knew you were being called to repentance. Well, anyway, I wondered what was going to happen now that President McKay was gone, because I knew that might be a change, but I had no idea. And my father said to me, well, son, he says, I think the day of warning for the church is past. He says, I don't think you'll ever hear it again in General Conference. It's over. He said, if President McKay can't move him, nobody can. He said, he has the look, the feel, the understanding, the love of a prophet. He's like a grandpa. He says, if he can't move him, nobody can. And so he said, I think it's over.
What year was that?
1970, when President McKay died. And so I've always felt sorry for people who say, why doesn't the church say more? I had it explained to me 36 years ago. And I've watched and listened ever since then. And other than a few talks which President Benson gave when he was the prophet, he put a few paragraphs in there so that you knew he hadn't changed his mind about one thing. I called Reed one day. He and I are pretty good friends. I said, Reed, I hear people say that President Benson's changed his mind about this stuff. And he says, my dad hasn't changed his mind about one single thing. Well, I guess we all have our perceptions. About 25 years ago, I was feeling a little discouraged one day, like people get. Sometimes you feel like you're right. You go up to the wall, you take your arrows and your hot oil and your spears, and you go back home and go back into battle the next day. But I said to my dad, who up there agrees with Ezra Taft Benson? And Dad mentioned 4 or 5 general authorities he knew of. This is back before my dad was a general authority. But one of them he mentioned was Gordon B. Hinckley. I don't remember who the others were, but that one stayed with me. But he said he understands the insiders, the international bankers, the one-worlders, and he understands all this stuff. He understands it. He agrees with Ezra Taft Benson on it. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And so when people sometimes also complain about what's being said, I tell them my opinion is we're not dealing with a stupid prophet. We're dealing with people who wouldn't take counsel. And so they've been shut up. The prophet understands this. We don't have a stupid prophet. We have people who wouldn't take counsel. And the decision was made 36 years ago that you've been warned. Well, moving on here. Who do you talk to about this type of stuff? Why is it the Lord can't have his prophets talk to us about this anymore? You know, you talk to members of the church, you can still get them stirred up. Just like they did 36 years ago, if you try to raise this. One thing I've concluded, the only people you can talk with are people that are honest in heart. And by that I mean they're meek, humble people. I guess I ought to throw in there just like me, but then my pride'd show. But people who are proud, they want to run other people's lives. They want to be involved in running other people's lives. And if they have this attitude that I'm superior to you and you're stupid, you're just fortunate to have me here to put laws in to force you to do things for your own good. You're too stupid to save for your old age. You're too stupid to save for your medical bills. You're too stupid to educate your children. You're too stupid to know who to shop for services from. You've got all these weaknesses, and you're just lucky to have me here to help you because you're stupid. And people that think that's charity to help you out like that, they've already lifted themselves up, and they're really not very teachable because they've got this barrier put up that says I'm smart and you're stupid. And so when you try to talk to them about agency and about the Lord's plan, they really can't understand what you're saying because you're attempting to say that someone else is smarter than them. Maybe it's the Lord, maybe it's a prophet, but they don't understand that. One example I'd like to use, my dad used to use sometimes, was the example of the story of Samuel in the Old Testament. You remember the Jews, well, the whole house of Israel, they'd had a reign of the judges for 425 years, where the head person of their government was also their judge. And you recall, after 425 years of this, the people came to Samuel and said, "We want a king. We want to be like other people." And Samuel went and talked to the Lord about it, and the Lord said, "Nah, they don't want a king." He says, "You tell them what they're going to get if they want a king." And so Samuel went back and said, "You don't want a king. Here's what the Lord said you're going to get if you go and get a king." Well, the people said, "We want a king anyway." And so Samuel went back and he felt pretty bad about it, because here he was, the prophet, and he was the prophet because Eli's sons hadn't been any good, and I guess Samuel's sons weren't any good. They were the best justice money could buy, I guess. But they didn't have any faith in the Lord and his prophets that he could fix things just like he did with Eli, raise up another righteous man. So anyway, the Lord had Samuel anoint Saul to be the king. Remember, Saul was a meek man. They had to go find him hiding in the tent. He didn't really want to do it. But after he became the king, he kept doing things the Lord told him not to do. And finally, Samuel got with him, and he said, "Saul," he said, "the kingdom's going to be taken from your house because you will not take counsel. You just won't do it." And after he told him that, Saul said to him, "Well, will you stand next to me and come out here in front of all the army so it looks like we're together on this? You still support me?" And Samuel said, "Yeah, I'll do that." So he went out there and stood with him while they had a little celebration. As far as the people knew, he was still with them. And to some degree he was. You remember when he said, "I want to go," the Lord came to him and said, "There's another guy I want you to anoint to be king." And Samuel said, "Well, I can't do that." He said, "As soon as Saul hears I'm doing that, he'll kill me." I mean, see, the people had busted the prophet down from head of the government to an advisor to the king. And now the prophet was afraid of the man. And the Lord says, "I just lie to him. Tell him you're going to go out and do some sacrificing, and I'll help you find the new king while you're out there." Well, Saul fouled up, then David fouled up, then Solomon fouled up, then Rehoboam fouled up, and on and on and on and on. The Lord knew all this, and he tried to tell the people, "This is what you ought to be doing." And the Lord's hand was in each of these people, but then they went bad, because they had rejected the counsel of their prophet. And I think this is where we are today. As Americans, of the LDS faith, we got the same problem. Our prophet has to appear to support people, because guess what? That's all we're willing to deal with as a whole. We're like these BYU students, the vast majority of us. We're communists. We don't want to be told that either. We don't want to be told our views aren't correct. And the way I look at you and I and all this stuff is you're like Joshua and Caleb. Remember when Moses marched them up to the land and they sent in a representative from each tribe and they came back and Joshua and Caleb said, "Let's go. We can take them." And the rest of them said, "Nah, we can't take them. Moses, you dog, you drawed us out here to die. We want to go back to Egypt." So Moses goes in, talks to the Lord, and the Lord said, "Oh, let's just kill them. They're a bunch of losers." And Moses says, "No, wait a minute, the word will get back to the Pharaoh. You know what you've done with his chosen people." The Lord says, "Okay, they're yours. You can take them, wander them out to the desert for 40 years till they all die off. They're a bunch of losers. You can try and teach their children to follow me and respect you and respect the Lord. When he asks you to do something, you can do it, but they're yours now." So there they went off, wandering around for 40 years. Thousands of them. When Moses went out and said, "You're a bunch of losers, I'm going to walk you out through the desert for 40 years, thousands of them said, "Well, we've had a change of thought. We're ready to go fight. We're going." And Moses said, "No, the Lord said, we can't win any battles. He's not with us anymore. They said, we want to go. He said, that was your choice yesterday. Today, you don't have a choice. We're going back to the desert. We're going to wander around. And thousands of them went down, tried to attack the Philistines. They got slaughtered. A bunch of them came back, and all the Israelites took off. One day. One day, if they'd chosen the Lord, he would have been with them. They could have gone in, but now they got to wander around the desert for 40 years while they die off. And I always thought that's interesting about Joshua and Caleb. They were men. They could have gone to Moses and said, well, we're not like them. Can't we go in? Let's go. You know, there's a few of us that are willing to follow you. No, they turned on a dime. When Moses said we're headed for the desert, they headed for the desert. They didn't join the thousands and said, well, we can take them. You've been telling us all this time we've been getting here that we can take them. We're going to do this. I believe prophets always know more about what's going on than they tell us about. Your scriptures, they're nothing but records of these prophets. If you go into Ether, he recorded the rise and fall of his people. Moroni, he recorded the rise and fall of his people. Well, Mormon and Moroni brought the record to us. And I think we'd be stupid if we believe that our prophet today isn't keeping record of us, just like the records were kept of the Antediluvians, the Nephites, the Jaredites. And as my dad observed a few times to me, what they're writing about us might not be as kind in private as what they're saying in public about how willing we are to follow them. I remember reading Spencer W. Kimball's history. He said the saddest day of his life was when the Mormons rejected the prophet's counsel on prohibition. Now, you can have varying opinions on that, but the prophet had one. And Spencer W. Kimball said that. The saddest day of his life was when the saints rejected the prophet's counsel, just on something like prohibition. These men have feelings, and they think about us, and they worry about us. My father, he had quite a library on communism. He bought all kinds of books. He had books written in Moscow that were sent over here in English. He couldn't read Russian, but he had books put out by the Communist Party here in the United States. He had all kinds of books written by communists, ex-communists, pro-communists, anti-communists. And I said to him one day, Dad, how come you have all these books on communism? And he said, well, I've been trying to find out what makes these people get involved in communism and socialism. He said, I'm studying it. I'm trying to figure out where they come from. He said, how could someone who's a human being be a communist? He said, look, everywhere they go, they murder hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people. Everywhere they go, he said, how could an educated person, how could a sane person, a human being, join an outfit like that? He said, where are they coming from? How can you think like that? How can you look past feelings and join a group like that? So he said, I'm trying to figure out what they think. He told me one day that the best explanation he found was in a book called Witness by Whitaker Chambers. I don't know if any of you have ever read that book before or not. He was the communist that nailed Alger Hiss. And this was a man that had been a communist. He had been an atheist. He had worked undercover in Washington, D.C. And Whitaker Chambers, in his evaluation of why people hated him and were so angry with him, and why this guy that he nailed had a couple of chief justices, which were character witnesses for him. A secretary of state was a character witness for him. And he said these people were saying terrible things about him, Whitaker Chambers, talking about this guy. And he said, what's the problem? Why do they hate me when I'm the one trying to protect them and trying to open their eyes, help them see what's going on? And then he made the observation. He said, the problem with these intellectuals and these people, he says, they've taken the exact same steps the communists have taken, the exact ones. They've rejected God. They've become proud. They want to run other people's lives. And they can't tell the difference between their views and the communist views. And then he made the observation, the reason they can't tell the difference is because there isn't any difference. Yeah, educated fools, useful idiots, you've heard all the the terms, people that think they're going to help the world be a better place, but they're susceptible to using force. A lot of these men, they mean well, but they come up with exactly the wrong answer, and the reason they've come up with the wrong answer is because they have rejected God. Now, this man became a Quaker, a total belief in God. He said, I'm leaving the winning side and going to the losing side. He said, because the American people can't conceive of a group of men who'll sit down and plot their destruction over generations. He said, the American people are too good to think that way. He said, they can't think like that. He said, that's why they'll lose. Of course, he didn't have the bigger picture, but that was his evaluation of his fellow Americans, Whitaker Chambers. Here's a statement by David O. McKay. During the first half of the 20th century, we have traveled far into the soul-destroying land of socialism. A lot of people think that socialism is just a way to redistribute wealth, to help the less fortunate. That's as far as they think of it, economics. But, as you remember that other quote we had from President McKay and those other men, it destroys nations. That's where it ends up. And here's another quote, it also destroys souls. It's evil in every way. But, you know, this is the first time I've done this to a group like this in about 9 years. You can't talk about it in church. What you can do about it, you can talk to your family, you can talk to your friends and your neighbors, you can try and find people that are honest in heart. The laws haven't changed as far as what's right and wrong. God's laws haven't changed as far as what's right and wrong. The number of people that understand it, that's less. One thing I found interesting, people call me once or twice a week from all over this country. And they say, can I get this or can I get that? And what's this and what's happened here and there? And I'll try to give them my thoughts on it. What I feel about it. I find there's good people all over the place. And I think about this, if I was God, why in the love of truth do you spread these people all over creation? Kind of like missionaries. I got a son in Japan right now. I had another one in Africa, another one in France. Why can't you put all these people in one place? You know, you don't have to travel all over the world to find good people. But they're out there. There are a lot of good people out there. A lot of good people that are thinking and praying and they're looking for what's truth. They're interested in it. I don't think we're going to get overwhelmed. My observation, there's two or three in each ward on average that even know what you're talking about if you talk about this stuff. So anyway, just keep talking to people. Yeah, it's there. Yeah, it's right there. And Ezra Taft Benson knew it. Gordon B. Hinckley knows it. These other prophets know it. Years ago, I asked my dad one day, when did you become a conservative, and that's a loose term, but anyway. And he said to me, it was when I was, he'd been to Stanford for 2 years, and then he went back to Harvard, to get his doctorate, and he said, I'd always been taught by my mother that you could find the answers to any question you have in the scriptures. And he said, I was back there at Harvard, and he said, I got to thinking one day, what does the Lord think about government and laws? And he'd been raised on a farm, he was a farm boy, and he said he'd always been taught the Constitution was given to us by the Lord, men raised up by the Lord, and we're supposed to obey the law. He said he knew that, but he said, I wondered what the Lord thought about government and law. And he said he'd never really thought much about it other than those couple of scriptures on it, 98 and 101. But anyway, he said to himself, the next time I go through the Book of Mormon, I'm going to look for what the Lord says about government and laws. And he said, so when he went through it this next time, he said he could not believe his eyes. Same thing this man just said. He said, there's more in there than anything else. He said, it just astounded him. When he started looking for it, he said, it's there. He said, and that's when he thought, boy, the Lord really does care about this stuff. He's got a lot to say about it, if we'll just read it. Well, this is personal, but I'll tell you, my first wife ran off with a boyfriend. We had 8 children. That hurt. I didn't know you could hurt like that. I did not know you could hurt like that. I concluded death was better than this. You start watching your children have questions and problems, and you say, where's God gone? I was one of those guys. I never even kissed my wife till the day we got married. And you know what my thinking was? If I say my prayers and pay my tithing, I cross my T's, I don't cross any lines, I'm going to get blessed. I'm going to expect to get blessed. You know what I found out? It doesn't always work. And that's devastating to find that out when you think you've tried to do your part. So anyway, that kind of took the soup out of me. I didn't know I could cry that much, feel that bad. And that took the soup out of me. But anyway, I'm married again. And she's great. I got a reason to live again. Yeah, for years I used to do a radio program down in Provo every week, going through stuff like this. Used to speak at the Newquist breakfast. used to run for office. I was really involved because I thought, like you're saying, with the knowledge I had, I better be doing something. I've got more instruction to me on that, too. I better be doing something. Well, I'm just starting to move again. I mean, you look at what happened to Nephi there in Helaman 3rd Nephi when he got up on his tower. All you knew about that man before that was that he was a good missionary and feeling pretty bad, pretty discouraged. And he comes home, gets on his tower, quite starts to pray. A big crowd gathers around. First thing you know, there's a wild-eyed right-winger up there. And what's his greatest sorrow? You people have elected Gadianton and robbers. You've altered the laws that King Mosiah gave us, that they had had for 500 years, filling the judgment seats, and they wanted to kill him. And even after he had miracle after miracle, it's what he'd accomplished. Remember, before he started the famines and so forth, he was stood in the street all by himself, president of the church, all by himself, and the people walked off and left him. I think we got more people to follow him today than he did, but that's pretty sad. Well, those of you that were here years ago, remember the division that came up in the church. 66, President McKay gave that official position, the Church on Communism, in priesthood meeting. And it's addressed, if you read the first paragraph, to the bishops and the stake presidents who keep writing me and asking me about this. And he says, let people join study groups. He says, I wish everybody was involved. And then a year and a half later, he gave another talk on unity. And said, if you can't get this figured out locally, then you write me, and I'll get it back to you. Then another year and a half later, gave another talk, and he threw in the towel. 69, he threw in the towel. He said, church leaders shouldn't take the lead in this freedom battle. We're baptizing people from all over the church. And so even before he died, he threw the towel in. Now, he still gave another firebrand talk after that, a couple of them. So did Ezra Taft Benson. But as far as the church leadership get involved in it, he pulled the plug on it, and I think it was because of unity. You know, they're putting satellites up all over the world, building temples all over the world, trying to teach these people. You know, you can get the conference addresses on these CDs. They're great to listen to over and over and over. I listen to conference every morning while I'm taking a shower. I stand there too long, but with conference, it's not as bad, you know. It doesn't, at least I don't appear as bad, you know. 501c3. Yeah, it's like one friend of mine, he was in the state legislature up here, he got defeated, but he was trying to get a bill through on immigration, on illegal immigration. And he got beat, and I said, well, why did some of your friends turn against you when you were trying to get this illegal immigration thing put through it to strengthen the law on that? He said, well, they were told that the Mexican government had threatened the church, limiting missionaries. My father was a general authority down there in Mexico City for 3 years, and they allow 400 non-Mexican missionaries in the entire country of Mexico. And he was always having to go over and explain, well, now these here aren't proselyting missionaries. They're setting up name extraction programs in different stakes. This man here, he's a builder. He's not a proselyter. And so sometimes the church is facing stuff that we don't ever see. They're getting threatened. Yeah, one of the funniest books I ever read was about 25, 30 years ago. Maybe it's more than that. Bill Richardson on Slightly to the Right. And he talks about this very thing, about what a right-winger does when he wakes up and starts looking around. And it's the funniest book. You know. Yeah, yeah. There's a commie under every bed. And you want to preach and give them the word, and nobody understands. And you're ducky lucky, and you're carry nation. You got your signs, and you're out, and nobody cares. Yeah, what a life. In this book, one of the things my father tried to point out, so we could, another reason to study the Book of Mormon, is some parallels that the Nephites had with us. And one of the first things he points out is self-rule, beginning with God's approved laws. We know what he says about the Constitution. We know what he said about the laws which Mosiah gave the people. Remember when they set up the reign of the judges? They adopted the laws which he said he got from God, and they had just in mass voted to adopt those laws. They also had the gospel, and they also had created a separation of church and state, which was interesting because prior to that, their prophet, often their king, they were the same people. And to them, the idea of separation of church and state would have been as foreign as anything you could say. It'd be as foreign as you saying we ought to have church and state today. That'd be just that foreign to them. But that's one of the things they created. Church and state, religion and politics. I'm just going to run through some of these titles to these pieces of my father's book. One of the things he points out is that the Book of Mormon covers 3,000 years of history, a couple of thousand of Jaredite, 1,000 of Nephite history, and yet a little over 40% of it covers 125 years. And this 125 years is when they had their self-rule. That's when he instructed the Mormon, the man who was compiling all this, to slow way down and start going blow by blow by blow. Here's what's happening. The Jaredites, remember, they were a far greater nation. They lived far longer, and yet there's just a very small part of the book that's devoted to them. But over 40% of the Book of Mormon deals with this 125 years when they had their self-rule. And you might ask, the Nephites had had 500 years of righteous kings. There's the one example of Noah, which Mosiah used and said, you don't want a guy like that to be your king, do you? You know, when he was talking them out of it and saying, you need to go to self-rule. But they had had a pretty good deal for 500 years. They'd had righteousness. The only fights they'd really had were when the Lamanites came on them occasionally. One reason they'd done fairly well is they consulted the prophets and the scriptures. And, of course, that's what we're taught to do if we want to have unity. And you might ask, why would the Lord go and set up a reign of the judges for 125 years just before Christ came, when they'd had such good fortune with these kings all these years? Well, suddenly people were going to have self-rule, and we'll get into that a little bit more a little bit later. And this is one for those of you who don't have it. It's brief. I'll read it. Next, being one and worshiping God, there is nothing in this world upon which this church should be more united than in upholding and defending the Constitution of the United States. So he's talking about there should be unity among us. Well, we've also discussed about the fact we don't have that kind of unity. But that's another thing that they were taught that they should have. And, of course, the only way to have unity is people are actually willing to follow the prophet, not fight him, not ignore him. That's the only way we can really have unity, because you and I can have differences of opinion. That's why after the destruction of the Lord's church, you end up with just about every belief on earth and every interpretation of the Bible. The only way we can have unity is if we're willing to follow the prophets. And go on to the next one. This was actually written. My dad wrote this back when President Benson was still alive. And possibly some of you still remember that talk he gave back in 86 when he said the whole church is still under condemnation for not listening and reading the Book of Mormon, not understanding it, not following it. And that was interesting. I don't remember when that's been said before, but the Lord gave it to Joseph Smith, I think, in 1832, and here our prophet says it again. We're still under condemnation because we haven't listened, we haven't followed it. And again, if people look to their own knowledge, they're not going to hear what a prophet says. It'll be past them. But anyway, that was what he said. Now this is interesting. He goes into this. He points out that the Gentiles, that includes us. Remember when they dedicated the Kirtland Temple, he talked about the Gentiles. We who are LDS are identified with the Gentiles. And the only place you can learn about this land and about the warnings to us about what we may have happen to us is out of the Book of Mormon. For instance, in Ether 2 and 9, where it says you serve God or you're going to be swept off. When ye shall see these things come among you, that ye shall awake to a sense of your awful situation because of this secret combination which shall be among you. Does he say it might be here? So if you don't have the Book of Mormon, you don't know these things. You don't know what happened to the Nephites. You don't know what happened to the Jaredites. You don't have the warning, which they said, guess what? You've got it too. The Israelites, they often had to get beat up before they woke up. The Nephites, remember the Lord, when he tried to clean them up, gave them famines, pestilence, war. And I used to ask my dad, when do you think the second coming's coming? When's this going to happen to us? When are we going to get our comeuppance? And he used to say, well, this Book of Mormon is a parallel, and he didn't think that it would happen to us until the Lamanites were able to carry their own water, so to speak. He said when they were strong enough to carry their own water, that he thought that's when the Lord would lower the boom on us, but he didn't have any idea. He said that's up to the Lord. He's the one that has a weight on that, can weigh it. Governments may be used to preserve or destroy freedom. Here Dad makes the observation in this chapter that in the pre-earth life, the war was over agency. The Nephites were given self-rule. It's been given to us. There are a lot of parallels to it. In the on your handout, I've got a quote there out of D&C 101, 77 to 80. Just do part of it. That every man may act according to the moral agency which I have given unto him, that every man may be accountable for his own sins in the day of judgment. He's talking about why did we get a Doctrine and Covenants with this statement about the Constitution. And then let's go on to the next one about the Nephites. I think you'll see a similarity here. He had to convince them they didn't want a king. And if you look at that next to the last line there, or above that, says, and every man expressed a willingness to answer for his own sins. And so here the people were voting to say, okay, I'll be responsible for my own sins. I can vote for what laws I want to be bound by. And the Lord explained to the prophet Joseph Smith, every man's going to be held accountable. because in a system where you can affect law, you're given a lot more. You've given a lot more opportunity. You can affect the way laws are going to go. You look at the history of the world, you say, isn't that interesting how few people have had self-rule? But the Lord chose you and me. He gave it to us, and he chose the Nephites. And the battle's still going on all over the world as to whether others are going to have it. Some have it to some degree. Okay, let's see here. The Lord said every man would be accountable. The Book of Mormon, they expressed a willingness. Okay, that's what we just went through here. The Nephites altered their laws when they got into secret combinations. And the Lord, my father felt, didn't put all this history in here just out of a coincidence. He thinks we needed to see it. Let's see, this is chapter 6. This is a pretty good chapter. Maybe it doesn't affect you women, but man, does he ever go after the men. He said, we have a tendency to exercise a controlled dominion, to destroy each other's agency. That's our nature to do it. He says it's our nature to do it. And this is on your handout. It's the nature and disposition of almost all men. As soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion. Hence, many are called, but few are chosen. And for the LDS people, that's a reference to priesthood. That section's on priesthood, and that means if we don't overcome this tendency, and it's one of the reasons Satan seems to have the easier road to hoe down here, and why he's always been able to destroy churches and civilizations over and over and over, because men fall to this tendency to destroy free agency. It's another reason the Lord doesn't hand it out to very many people in the history of the world. But we've got it. One of the things my dad points out here also in this chapter is that one of the ways Satan has got a hold of the Mormons, who should know better, is that we can't apply our private morality to our government morality. We truly do try to separate church and state. We don't go say, what did David O. McKay say about socialism? Did you know that Joseph Smith himself attended a lecture on socialism, said he rejected the doctrine? And you can find statements like that, all 15 prophets, but unless you go look for it and then find out what socialism really is, you don't know you're being taken down that road, that you're falling to this inclination we have to exercise unrighteous dominion. Every act which government performs is either morally right or morally wrong. Government is justified only because there exists a code of private morality which should be enforced. And you and I hopefully get ours from God and from our prophets as to what should be. Sometimes people get after the Bible. They say, can you believe God used to kill people? Or tell Moses to kill people for picking up sticks on the Sabbath? And I say, yeah, the Lord gives different people different levels of knowledge. And then he can hold them accountable and bless them or curse them based on their obedience. I know I talked to my dad about that one day, and he said, well, he said the Lord was feeding those people every day. He said he put a cloud over them while they were walking through the desert. It wasn't quite so hot. Their clothes couldn't wear out. Gave them water every day. He said they had a pillar of fire by night. They didn't have to set. He said anybody that could violate any of God's laws ought to be hammered, because that's just like being in your face. But they had more knowledge, and so they could have a heavier hand placed on them. But again, you got to have faith in God and His prophets, His scriptures, before you can even talk to people like that. They're off on their own little tangent about right and wrong. Okay, let's go to the next one. Here, my dad went and talked about pride. And I mentioned this earlier. Pride is what opens the door for us to say, okay, I'm smarter than you. And that's what opens the door to us to believe in socialism. It's what opens the door for us to end up a communist and end up destroying our freedom and other people's freedom. It's our pride. It's what gets us lifted up. That's where we put the barrier up and say, I'm smarter than the rest of you. My dad goes into this. My dad, he had a funny way of saying this. I'll quote it. He said, Daddy, you said, if pride were a disease, it would be the worst kind of disease because the victim of pride is blinded to an awareness of the symptoms of the disease to the same degree he is afflicted with the disease. Hence, we can't see it. And I always thought that's interesting. Helps explain why Satan got into much trouble. He talks about the first exercise of agency we have record of in the scriptures was when Satan and Christ presented two alternative plans. And you and I exercised our agency. I'm sure there was exercising agency before that, but that's the first scriptural record we have of it. And when Satan's plan was rejected, in his pride, he rebelled. And this is something people, you got to get this out of modern scripture. But here's where we learn something about Satan's character. Now, this is on your handout. And now when Moses had said these words, Satan cried with a loud voice and ranted upon the earth and commanded, saying, I am the only begotten, worship me. And it came to pass that Satan cried with a loud voice, with weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth, and he departed hence. I'd just like to have that guy for your boss. Yeah, he's throwing a tantrum. But it shows you something about his nature, what type of a person he is. And it's not where you want to be. He got the ultimate, I want to exercise unrighteous dominion on you. And again, he's here trying to seduce us to follow that same plan again. Exercise unrighteous dominion on others. And he's got another shot at us. This one here, we've already talked about the fact they had their 500 years of the reign of the judges and the kings enforced the Ten Commandments. Sometimes, even after they started chief judges, you'll notice that sons were made the next chief judge. So I just make the observation that they were affected by the what had been going on before. Here, my father talks about in two kinds of priestcraft, enforced priestcraft and unenforced priestcraft. And he talks about in the Book of Mormon, the first type of priestcraft we have record of is when King Noah taxed the people. You know, 20% to support his priests. He put down the priest that his father had anointed to teach the people, and he was a wicked man. I've always wondered why wouldn't his father have picked somebody else to be the king? That's poor judgment. But when you see the Lord had the same kind of run with the people, which were meek men and humble men until they got in positions of power, I guess it's a weakness we can. Look, we all might have. But anyway, he goes and talks about other priestcrafters that the Nephites had to deal with. The Amulonites, remember they were the descendants of Amulon, one of the wicked priests of King Noah. Then there were the Amlicites. They tried to enforce priestcraft. Remember they had an election of whether or not to go back to have kings and have priestcraft enforced on the people, and they just barely won that election. They talk about how happy the people were that they were not going to have to live under priestcraft, and the church would have been destroyed if Amlici had been elected king. Then you've got the people of Ammonihah. Remember that city that they practiced priestcraft until they were destroyed. The Zoramites, they practiced it, and then they went off and joined the Lamanites, after the missionaries went over there and tried to convert them, they drove the righteous that were left out of their land. So they had a lot of dealings with priestcraft. Then let's go on to the next one. The Nephite experience with secret combinations. This one, Dad points out, the first 60 years during their self-rule, they were dealing with this priestcraft which got involved. They had 60 years of different people attempting to stir the people up, and they had great rebellions, great insurrections, fighting, and so forth. They had 60 years of dealing with priestcrafters. The next 60 years, they were dealing with secret combinations trying to get control of the government. And 40 years into it is when Gaddi Anton started his deal, but it wasn't for another 20 years until the Gaddi Anton robbers and their secret combinations and their efforts to get control of the government became a big deal. That when they started getting powerful enough that the Nephites, the Lamanites joined together to try to fight these Gaddi Anton robbers. And I think it's true then, it's true today, the Lord gives people their agency. He doesn't put he doesn't have an angel follow us around with a two before, and every time we start thinking, I think socialism's a good idea in this case, we don't get hit up the side of the head with a two before. We're allowed to rock and roll right down the road to full-blown socialism and fullness of iniquity. We're allowed to do that. These secret combinations, you'll probably remember, they finally did overthrow the Nephite government. And the Nephites that did not want to be part of them, they all gathered together in one area. Remember, they brought 7 years of food together. And they fought. And the poor thieves couldn't get anything to eat. And they got weaker and weaker. And finally, they got wiped out. But then Dad points out, just 7 years later, again, the teachings of these Gaddi Anton robbers were running rampant through these people again. And these secret combinations. Remember, they talked about the Nephites. They built them up. They joined with them, and this time they overthrew the Nephite government again, but they couldn't hold it together. They couldn't hold it. Now, that's when they divided up into all these different tribes. And that was just 4 years after they were busted up into all these different tribes that the Lord came. Okay, the Constitution, the United States of America, is approved by the Lord. Oh, one other thing I wanted to cover here. Oh, this is on your handout. Don't mind me, I got things back and forth here that you don't see, that I miss too sometimes. On your handout, when the Lord came, when he spoke to them and said what he had done, he said, "And behold, that great city Jacobugath, which was inhabited by the people of King Jacob, have I caused to be burned with fire because of their sins and their wickedness." And what does he say about that? "Which was above all the wickedness of the whole earth because of their secret murders and combinations. For it was they that did destroy the peace of my people and the government of the land." So there you've got it right there. The Lord talking to these people. He says, here's what I did to them and here's why I did it. And I think he goes through and lists 15 other cities that he just wiped out too. Just wiped them out. But that's what the Lord said was the greatest wickedness. Chapter 13 is about secret combinations. Something else my dad points out here in chapter 13 about the antediluvians. If you go and read Moses and Abraham, they were taken down by secret combinations. And 8 people survived that when the Lord said, okay, everybody out of the boat, except these 8. And that's all that lived through that. And then the secret combinations took down the Jaredites. 2 men survived that. The king and who lived 9 more months, and then Ether, who recorded it. And then the Nephites, when the secret combinations wiped them out, 1 man was left. You know, that's civilization to tell us what had happened. Okay, chapter 14. This goes back to your handout again. This is out of the Doctrine and Covenants. Dad points out, many people think the only inspired part of the Constitution is the ability to amend it. They don't like this idea of in the tradition of the founding fathers. They think anything we voted that we change, that's okay and that's good. But Dad points out, this is out of, on the handout also, "And that law of the land, which is constitutional, supporting that principle of freedom and maintaining rights and privileges, belongs to all mankind and is justifiable before me. Therefore, I, the Lord, justify you and your brethren of my church in befriending that law, which is the constitutional law of the land, proclaiming the law of man, whatever more or less this cometh of evil. And so, yes, the Constitution does have the ability to alter and amend it, but we saw what the Nephites did when they could alter and amend their laws, how they corrupted what they had been given, and we have to be real careful when we amend our Constitution, what's right and wrong, if we're going against the things the Lord's given us and undoing what he's given us. Of course, most of what I see, they just ignore the Constitution. Nobody's ever read it, especially the 9th and 10th. It's nobody reads it so they can get away with it. The light of Christ is given to every man that and woman that comes to the earth. On that golden rule thing, my father said he used to teach these principles to his students every semester, first 2 weeks. And he said he used to get a lot of angry people. The students would really get angry when he'd try to teach them. And he said it took him years before he figured out a better way to teach it. And he said what he did, he started asking the students, I want you to pretend you're the king, that you're the ruler and you're going to make laws. But he said, I want you to write down the laws you want, but then I want you to write down your justification for it, for compelling this person to do this or taxing this person, you know, to support this law which you favor. And he said, I want that part of your paper when you write this up. He said, you can disagree with me. Some of them got angry with him because they thought he was imposing his views on them. But he said that the interesting thing to him is he said when they had to address their own conscience and say, okay, how am I going to justify forcing this man to pay for this man's children's education? Or how can I justify forcing this man to save for his old age or his medical bills or housing or be charitable? How could you justify it? When they had to address their own conscience, they ran into trouble. And he said only the most hard-hearted people were still fighting because then they had to fight their own conscience. That light of Christ, which is given to all of us, if we'll just look at it. That golden rule works if we can get people to look at it. And I put that on your handout, the golden rule. Therefore, all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them. For this is the law and the prophets. And that's the Savior speaking again. Chapter 16 deals with the divine law. Here, my father points out that everybody that is involved in inventing things, building things, doing research, they're trying to find some law to make better steel or better plastic or better clothing or better lighting or whatever it is they're trying to produce. And he said they know that if they can make something happen once, it'll happen again and again and again and again. What they know is that there are physical laws which exist which are absolute, and all they have to do is discover that law, what act they needed to do, repeat it over and over and over and over, and then they can produce all these things that we've got around us because those laws exist. And how silly it is for men not to think that God would give us laws on how we ought to treat each other and give us absolute laws on the proper role of government. I always thought that was interesting. Why didn't people think of that? God's given us laws dealing with our physical things around us. Why would we think he wouldn't give these other laws to us too? Then the next thing I've got on your handout, elements of freedom. They're life, liberty, knowledge, and the right and control of property. And, of course, if you destroy any one of these, you've made the others ineffectual. They're of no value to you. Government's there to protect our freedoms. It should be. And I think one of the greatest examples of this is this thing we've got with immigration right now. I don't know if you saw this report the Pew Research Group put out, said 46% of people living in Mexico wanted to live up here. And I thought, well, they're coming. And I thought, isn't it? My dad, he lived down there for 3 years. When he was general authority, he said, you know, Mexico has a milder climate than we do here. He says they actually have more natural resources than we do here. He said, and fewer people. He says, so why do they want to come up here? Well, it's their government. They want to go someplace where they can keep the fruits of their labors, even if they're doing a lot of them, poor-paying jobs. It's not that they like our sunshine. It's their government. That's what they're escaping from. That's why they're coming. I'm not saying they should be here, but I'm just making that observation. That's why people come here. As bad as we are, you got to look at the rest of the world. They are really messed up, yeah. I went down there, what's it been, 8-9 years ago, to a place called Torreon, Mexico. A client of mine was thinking of buying into an aloe vera farm down there. He couldn't believe the numbers, and so he sent me down there. I spent 3 days down there. Stayed in a nice 5-star hotel, pretty nice. Went out on payday. I wanted to see all these people working. And these guys work out there in the heat of the day, just hot, for $2.75 a day, all day. And the women were working where they were separating the aloe vera plants and separating and so forth. They were working in the shade. But I thought, isn't that something? Those people will work like that out there all day. And I watched the guy come out there in the morning with all these Mexicans in his pickup. They paid him 25 cents a person to go around the little villages and pick them up, you know, and bring them there to this place. I talked to a guy down there. There's one other gringo in this hotel. And I went over to him and I said, hey, what are you doing down here? He said, I'm a sewing machine repairman. And I said, really? But, you know, I'm a CPA, you know. That's why I'm here. I'm so important. You're just a sewing machine repairman, huh? I didn't say that, but that's what I was thinking. How'd you get in here too, you know? And so, anyway, I said, well, what are you doing here? He named some big clothing company that he worked for up here in the States. And he said, we have a sewing company down here. It hires 500 Mexican girls. And he says, we pay them $1.75 a day. And he says, you know what? We don't have any OSHA. We don't have any EPA. We don't have any unions to deal with. He said, this is sweet. He said, we bring all the clothing down here. It's cut up in the States. We truck it all down here, and it's all sewn together and taken back up. He says, you know, and if one of these girls doesn't produce, there's 300 more standing right there at that door. They want that job. They want it that bad. I thought, brother, this is something. But they have an unjust system down there, and when they come up here, they're trying to get away from it. And they do love welfare. That's true. I could tell you a bunch of stories about that, but better move on. Yeah, they discover it and they use it. Government shall punish nothing except the intentional violation of duties, licensing laws. When my dad was in the state legislature, he introduced a bill to try to get all licensing laws in the state of Utah repealed. Well, let me say this about that. The Gadiant and robbers are alive and well. The fact that the Lord has a monetary system he likes. He told the Nephites. And then our Constitution outlines what he wants. We're not going to see the results of abandoning this until the roof caves in, I don't think. The banking system, they've learned that if they don't steal more than 3 or 4% from us a year through inflation, most of us don't complain much. And so as long as they don't steal very much from us, we don't get too upset. Back 81, 82, I was the foreman of a federal grand jury. And most of the people in that grand jury were LDS, and this is back when the gold standard was being considered to be gone back on by Reagan. And so anyway, I was the foreman of this grand jury, and I started educating these people about the Constitution. This after we'd had 4 years of Carter, and Reagan had been in the first year. You know what inflation was for those 5 years? Wholesale price index, 46.5% for 5 years. That was what the inflation was for 5 years. A 30-year mortgage, if you could get it, was 18% fixed rate. A lot of people were upset. And so when I taught them about the Constitution, I said, this nation's in trouble because we don't follow the Constitution. And we ended up indicting the Federal Reserve System for violation of U.S. currency laws. Yeah, you should have been there when the judge laid into us. Yeah. Then the U.S. attorney, we did it again. That really made him mad. And then we voted to send out these subpoenas, you know, requesting all this stuff, and that made them all the madder. We had, 17 meetings scheduled, and they canceled 14 of them. We were kind of married but separated, you know. They took all our cases and hauled them up to a grand jury up in Ogden. The U.S. attorney called us the runaway grand jury. But anyway, we won't see the results of this until the roof caves in on us, I don't think. If you look at it, China is just sopping up all our money they can get. Japan still holds more than China is. Yeah, they're coming back in here and buying a lot of our properties up. But as bad as our system is, it's still better than theirs. So they still want our money. We have billions and billions of dollars every month, negative balance of trade, because they still want our money. And you're right, they're coming in buying us up. Well, I don't know what's going to happen. Lord runs the whole show. If you see him standing there next to the prophet, you know what he thinks, what the prophet's thinking. That was so neat to go through those letters. I don't stay up nights wondering who's right and who's wrong. I just feel sorry for people who don't see the big picture, who just don't see it. But yeah, he went through that. One of the letters he wrote his mother, he said, this isn't a big trial to me, but he said, I see this being taken out on my children, you know, the way they're being treated. But anyway, that's life. Well, this next chapter, 25, deals with public schools, and that's, of course, the 10th plank of the Communist Manifesto, and it provides for a godless education. On the handout, this goes out of a church news quote. There's another one in the Relief Society magazine I didn't go to, but as far as our courts go, or our schools go, the Supreme Court misinterprets the true meaning of the First Amendment and are now leading this Christian nation down the road to atheism. That's back in 63. And I don't think many Mormons believe that. Chapters 26 and 27, they deal with public education and priestcraft and the warnings to us. You can go on 28. We've already talked about the fate of the Gentiles. In chapter 29, the last one, this is the same title as the first chapter. If you're not one, you're not mine. And this is another appeal to go back and follow the prophet. Follow him, do what we're asked. So don't end up like the Israelites or the Nephites or the Jaredites. We've got an eternal thing we're dealing with here. No, it's not being published. No, it was quite popular. All these books were. My dad went on a couple of missions with my mother back in, his first one was 81 when he went to Argentina. Then he went another to Peru, and then after that he was made a general authority. Now, what happened some years back, I'd heard a rumor that they didn't want me doing my dad's books published anymore. And it's a lot longer story than that, but I'm going to take some real quickie jumps. And so anyway, I wrote a letter and went up to see one of the brethren, and he suggests I go to see the First Presidency or write him a letter. I wrote them a letter, and they asked me to quit printing my dad's books. I also found out that they'd also quit printing Ezra Taft Benson's books. They were no longer available. Well, I was never told why. I think what it amounts to is whichever explanation you would like from the six or eight people who offered them here today. I don't know. I figure I'll get that explained to me in the next life. I just figure the Lord's got his own deal. I look, there's people in Africa, Asia, India that have a lot less than we have. And the Lord decides who to give what knowledge and what opportunity to hear the truth, what opportunity to act on it, and for whatever reason, I think if my dad hadn't been a general authority, they wouldn't have cared. I mean, you know, lots of people write lots of books. The only two I've heard have been blackballed, there's been my dad's and Ezra Taft Benson's. But they were quite similar. And if you went through a lot of pile of letters, you'd see why. those men were good friends. But you can take my explanation for it. You can take whatever you think, but that's what's happened. But we sold thousands of them. This many are called. That was out of print before any of the rest of them, after I got my letter saying don't print them anymore. And so we thought that was gone. And then years later, the guy that had printing them found 1,300 more on a pallet, or 1,300 more. And so he gave those to me, got them a few years ago, and we're down to, we got three boxes left. Well, now we got two boxes left and whatever's left there. But anyway, that's the story of it. And like I say, you can take any explanation you want as to why. Any other questions? Try and find them. You can find them in Deseret Industries every so often. Some fellow dies and his kids go haul all the books to DI. And you can find them down there sometimes. I shop there myself and find them sometimes. Give them to friends. People still call all the time looking for it, but many are called but few are chosen. That's then the great and abominable church of the devil and the moral basis of a free society and the Book of Mormon and the Constitution. The Book of Mormon and the Constitution is probably the poorest written one of the bunch, because I worked on it a bunch, but that's a longer story. But I only took stuff and put it together. I didn't take any license to change anything, but it was not, he never felt it was fixed up the way he wanted to have it fixed up. I remember when he was getting ready to go down to Argentina or Peru on a mission. My dad just lived a couple of doors away from me, and President Benson used to call him all the time. Well, this before he was the prophet, but I remember my dad he'd come home for a week or two, then go back down there. And so instead of putting a phone in, he'd come over, and Elder Benson would call my dad all the time, but he'd call me, and I'd get my dad and come back, and I used to hear halves of all these conversations. And I'd think, I shouldn't be here listening to this, so I'd get up and walk out, but pretty soon my feet would drag me back in there again, you know. And so I heard a lot of good stuff, but one of them was, Ezra Taft Benson was trying to get my father to get this book, the Book of Mormon, the Constitution, put together and get it finished. And I remember he really got after Dad this one time. And after they hung up, Dad said, man, he really wants that out. But what happens after you become a general authority, you can't just publish books anymore. You have to go through a committee of general authorities. So anyway, after he called, he was the first general authority. When President Benson became the prophet, he was the first general authority that he called. But when his book went through reviews, it kept getting rejected. But I think it's because of this same problem we've already discussed. You know, the people just wouldn't believe it. Deseret Book would not even carry his books when he was a general authority. They wouldn't even carry them. And I always had people calling up, say, hey, Deseret Book says your dad's books are out of print. I says, no, I've got them right here. So I'd call Deseret Book, write a letter, say, I've got them here. But they wouldn't carry them. They refused to carry them. They carried, some guy got them in there 3 or 4 years after my father died, who carried hundreds of titles, and I don't know what was going on behind the scenes. I don't have any idea. But anyway, you get involved in this fight, you run into lots of things. I give you all kinds of war stories. When my dad was at BYU, well, one for education. He used to be one of these lectures that traveled all over the country with what they call Leadership Week, and then they changed the name to Education Week, and he traveled all over because he was one of the biggest drawers of crowds. And they came to him after he'd been doing this for a number of years and said, you know, we really like to have you on the lecture circuit with us going all over the place. But he said, the head of it said, we don't want you teaching what you're teaching anymore because it's causing contention with what some of the other faculty members that are talking about. And so we'd love to have you keep teaching. But my dad said, well, the only reason I go off and leave my family, and sometimes he'd take us with him, is so I can teach these things. And if I can't teach those things, then I won't go anymore. And so he was put out of the Education Week. There was another instance where the head of the college came to him and told him that he wasn't supposed to teach about the Book of Mormon and the Constitution in his business law classes anymore because it had complaints that people in the econ department were complaining that they were quoting Verlin Anderson against what they were teaching. The poli-sci department was complaining they were quoting Verlin Anderson against what they were teaching, and would he please quit doing that? Well, anyway, this letter that we quoted part of, David O. McKay, to the we're all friends here. My dad actually helped draft that letter. He and Wilkinson were pretty tight. So when this guy came to him, the head of the college, and said, I don't want you teaching this anymore, Dad got out this letter. And he said, now, he says, I want to do exactly what the prophet wants me to do, so I want you to read this. This was handed out to all the faculty with our contract renewals this last year. And if I'm doing something the prophet doesn't want me to do, I want to be the first to know about it. And so anyway, he took it, and the guy came back a few weeks later, and he said, let's just pretend we never had this conversation, you know. And he said, oh, by the way, you've got some friends in Salt Lake. One of the saddest ones was just before Dad died. This friend is a multi-millionaire. Came to him, said he'd gone up to BYU. He wanted to set up a chair to honor Dad because he thought just the way Dad did. He'd taken his mother with him. They were both
worth piles. And anyway, they went up there and they wanted to set up a chair to honor my father. You know, and you can fund these things with money. And anyway, just a few weeks before my dad died, he came to tell my dad, BYU took his money, but they didn't want to honor him. They wanted to honor somebody else. So they set up a chair honoring someone else they wanted to honor. My dad couldn't have cared less. I mean, I could go on about the battles he had at BYU that just didn't stop. And this was just another little nothing one. But the fight goes on. It goes on and on. And all you can do is stick to your guns and stick to the prophet. Personally, I can tell you that I've got good friends in the Constitution part. I file the FEC reports for Scott Bradley and Jim Norlander and Mark Hudson. If you read these men's websites and see what they're doing, I think they're good men. What's happening is the Republican Party is getting split. And this is probably one of the bigger years for a split as people finally give up in trying to save it. But people can do what they want to do. They've got their agency and they go where they feel they can do the most good. And that's what we ought to be doing. I saw something the other day on these phone companies. I can't remember which one it was. Maybe it was AT&T. Anyway, they had a record that maintained in their computers of all telephone calls going back 25 years. Who they called and how long they talked. Not what they said. I'm a CPA. I've got clients who say, well, I'm not going to do this and this. The government will find out in my bank. You find out there's no place to hide. There's no place to go anymore. I go up the Peace River country up in Canada and hide out, but I don't think the Lord expects us to do that either. I really think that David O. McKay asked him to do what he did in setting up that Freeman Institute. I used to go to it when it was. He set it up down there just on the south side of campus. I used to live just a couple of doors from him when I was a kid. My dad and he were friends, lived just a few doors apart. A lot of what he did was aiming at the world, so to speak. You know, he traveled quite a bit with his Freeman Institute, and so he was restricted in that he couldn't do what we've done here today. Talk about the Book of Mormon. Talk about the Doctrine and Covenants. Talk about the prophets. Talk about the warnings that you and I can talk about. He couldn't do any of that, or very, very little of it, as far as, you know, dealing with what. But he had a mission there, and I think he really worked hard to teach people. I had great times. I was always fun getting to be Verlin Anderson's son and talking to people all over this country. Well, I still get to do it, but not as much as I used to. We're just finishing up a book on my dad's history of biography my mother's putting together, and we're going to put a disc in there that's going to have all his books on it, on a CD. It'll be in Word so it can be looked at, and I'd imagine some relatives will make those available to people. I mean, you can do a CD for 35, 40 cents, and you'd have all the books. Don't let apostates run over the top of you. Stay involved, yeah. Well, different people, yeah, I agree with you, but different people read things and they interpret them different, and we're still allowed to do that. Well, whenever I see things like that, I think of Samuel standing there next to Saul after he'd just given him a Dutch blessing. And all Israel thought he was right there with him. Well, thank you for inviting me. This has been fun. Thank you.